Welcome back to Innovation Hub. I'm Kara Miller. During World War II, pilots had to worry about being shot down, taken prisoner, or accidentally crashing. In today's military, many pilots sit in places like Grand Forks, North Dakota, while their unmanned drones hover over war zones thousands of miles away. And that's not the only thing that's changing. Social media, robots, and algorithms offer some solutions, but they also bring up thorny moral questions. Joining me to look at what's happening are Peter Singer, a senior fellow at the New America Foundation and author, most recently, of Ghost Fleet, and Missy Cummings, director of Duke's Humans and Autonomy Lab and one of the U.S. Navy's first female fighter pilots. Thanks to both of you for your time.
Thanks for having us.
So I want to talk here about the future of war, but let's look first at what war in the present is telling us about war in the future. And Missy, if you think about many of America's ongoing conflicts right now, it's kind of hard to tell what victory looks like. Do you see that as a part of wars in the future?
Well, I think if you look historically, we have had more crisply defined wars, but as time has gone in more recent times, I do think it's more nebulous what the boundaries of war are. And I certainly think as a technologist that the technology helps to keep that space a little bit more ambiguous, because with our increasing ability to do standoff surveillance, for example, and weapon delivery, then, you know, our reach becomes so much greater with much less threat to ourselves.
Right. And Peter, you've written and thought about our ongoing struggle with ISIS, and it's this very asymmetrical war. I wonder if all the technology in the world matters in that kind of struggle.
Well, technology is just a tool that you apply to a task. So it matters because neither of us or ISIS is fighting naked and barehanded. But we're finding that the technology is both delivering in new ways that's proving to be a challenge. So an example would be how nimble and effective ISIS has been with social media as compared to the U.S. On the other hand, some technologies are not delivering in the same old ways. So, for example, we've carried out more than 5,000 airstrikes on ISIS with just an amazing level of accuracy. And particularly if you compared it to history, I mean, the accuracy rate in World War II was like 4%. Against stationary targets. Maybe the lesson that we're learning is that the future of war is Game of Thrones meets Mad Men.
Yikes.
And that what's playing out, yikes is an example. What's playing out is it's this mix of these Byzantine, challenging, shifting alliances and also spin a narrative. Another way of putting it is, part of the success of ISIS has been this narrative that this marketing that would do Don Draper well. On the other hand, the kind of ugly, seamy side of politics and shifting alliances that would do Littlefinger from Game of Thrones well. And these are neither of which are things that we do really all that well right now.
Well, it's interesting that you sort of make that technological point about our accuracy in hitting targets, because in some ways, I think people would definitely assume that the U.S. has technology on our side here. But, you know, as you point out, if the other side's really good at Twitter and really good at YouTube and really good at social media, maybe it's not so clear who has technology on their side.
And they also now have some of the same technologies, whether it's the social media side to new things like unmanned systems, like drones. The conflict against ISIS is one in which every single actor of all the different sides, be it us, be it the Iraqis, be it the Iranians, to ISIS itself, have all operated drones. Not just drones in the air, but recently a militia in Iraq showed off a machine gun armed ground robot that they'd built themselves, controlled with a tablet computer. And that's really maybe the biggest difference for the U.S. moving forward in our assumptions in war, is that for the last 50 years, we've assumed that we'd always be a generation ahead of everyone else.
Right.
Between off-the-shelf technology, but also adversaries. Being an ISIS, or, you know, my next book is looking at this challenge of a fight against a great state like a China. We may not have that edge. They may have the same, or in some cases, even better technology to us. And that's a huge change.
Missy Cummings, you work on this technology all the time. Have you been surprised how quickly it's proliferated?
No. I have been predicting this proliferation for some time. I think what people fail to realize are that drones are actually a very simple technology, and they're not really a hardware issue. You can print your own drone now using a 3D printer, a very common technology all over the world. The innovation for drones is software, and software is not something the United States has actually spent a lot of resources on. We spend so much of our defense budget on building large laser-based weapons,
right,
or rail guns and things like that, and we think of software as kind of this nuisance development that has to come along with the hardware development, and we don't really invest a lot of money. And so what we fail to realize as a nation is, because drone development is really a software race, there are lots of people outside of this country who are just as good software development, and the barrier to entry is really low.
Right.
You only need a few $100s for a drone. Anyone in the world can buy a DJI drone or even a 3D robotics drone, and there's a fine line between toy and weapons platform now. And so I have been predicting for some time that you are going to see the software development accelerate outside of this country. And within just a few years, if it's not already happening right now, you're going to see capabilities in other countries and also in commercial companies that exceed what the U.S. is capable of.
Well, it makes me think of like teenage hackers in Eastern Europe. I mean, these aren't people with, you know, tons of money at their disposal or 30-year careers behind them. But as you say, that doesn't mean they can't, you know, manipulate a computer to make it do what they want it to do.
That's right. So everywhere, everyone can be a good software programmer. You know, and I think it's a tribute to education that we were trying to globalize education and put Coursera and courses online. But what that does is it raises everyone's ability. And when we're just talking about bits and bytes that get programmed into very cheap hardware that you can buy off of Amazon.com and then potentially be delivered by that company,
right,
we're in a whole new ballgame.
Well, and the notion that somebody could hack war, where you could have like two players that are at war and everybody understands who those two players in the war are, but then you can have outside small-time people who say, well, I'm going to try to hack the software or the systems that are being used to conduct this war. That's kind of mind-blowing.
Yeah, and that hack can be, in both meanings of the term, it can be going after trusted weapon systems in new ways. So in the Ghost Fleet project that looks at this, you know, scenario of what would happen in a World War III, one of the things it looks like is the very real vulnerabilities that are now baked into U.S. weapon systems because of the microchips that we use that are made in China. So what would happen if you go to war with China? But then you have the other meaning of hack, which is people coming at it in new, interesting, smart ways. So a difference with World War II is that, you know, back then you had a Detroit. Well, what's the equivalent of Detroit today? It's Silicon Valley. What role would Silicon Valley do in a World War III? And
right,
it's going to do a lot of its own things, not just what the government tells us, which
right,
is, you know, fun from a real but also fictional standpoint.
But this is a critical development that I think is not been taken seriously enough by this country, and that's the commercialization of robotic technology. So Google, a couple of years ago, bought up the top eight robotics companies
right,
in the world, one of which was Boston Dynamics, which was the lead robotics defense developer for the United States. And so I think what's happening is we are also seeing a global shift in development of robotics away from the military to the commercial sector. And while that's not necessarily an obvious threat to the United States, when all your top talent is being pulled to the commercial sector, most students who are in the robotics field flock to Silicon Valley like moths to a flame. And so we are left with a stale and stagnant defense industry in terms of robotics development, which is, again, primarily software development. And then we're seeing rapid advances in the rest of the world to fill that gap.
So it sounds like you're worried that, you know, if we went to war, the technology that exists, let's say inside Google right now, the people at the head of Google would say, well, I don't really want this to be, you know, essentially weaponized. I mean, I don't want this to be technology that the Defense Department uses, or at least they have that power.
That's right. And Google has publicly stated that they're happy to let their defense contracts just end and not renew them. Google is not interested in funding defense technology.
Right.
Google is interested in funding commercial technology that supports the stakeholders. And so in the end, it's not that Google is anti-military, but that's just not where the business is.
Right.
Right now, the Pentagon is beginning belatedly to realize that it's been falling behind in the innovation game. And so it's made a push to Silicon Valley. And there was a recent article about it that I think captured it really well, where it said the Pentagon is starting to try and court Silicon Valley. The problem is Silicon Valley looks at the Pentagon the same way Superman looks at kryptonite. It
Yikes.
Just doesn't want to do business with it for a wide variety of reasons that are everything from it doesn't think it's highly profitable to the issues of war to the legacy of the Snowden affair, you name it. But then there's a separate question, which is how does this change if it shifts from the period of today to an actual major state war, a kind of level of a World War II, an existential question. And it's not just a company like a Google, but it's also, you know, any multinational corporation, you know, be it a Walmart or whatever, is going to have to figure out for itself, is it truly multinational in its definition, or does it go with where its home headquarters are? And that's, again, the kind of debate that we haven't seen in war before that you could see play out.
Missy Cummings from Duke, if we think about what this major war of the future looks like, and we think about robotics, which you were mentioning, there's already obviously robots that detonate bombs that try to defuse them. So they're already being used, but there's a lot more out there that can be used. There must be some thinking about all robotic forces, or mostly robotic forces with a very, very light footprint from people. Do you think that is the direction that, like, armies are moving in?
Well, our own army stated that basically this year they would be one-third robot. But that was an estimate they made a few years ago, and they fell short of that. But it's certainly on their radar that they could be predominantly robotic. Israel has said that it's going to completely be robotic in terms of fighter bombers in the next 30 to 40 years.
Wow.
And so people are thinking that way. They're, you know, when you think about it, what are robots good for? They're good to go into hostile environments. Well, that's war. And while we're not close at all to having humanoid soldiers go into battle to do hand-to-hand combat, certainly aviation will become increasingly robotic. And you will see transportation vehicles, submarines, really any vehicle that has you can control its direction and speed, this will be something that will become a robot very, very soon.
Now, I mean, it seems like certainly on the political side, it would be a lot easier for a president to green light a war if he didn't have to say, we're going to suffer massive casualties. If he could say, look, you know, we are going into war, but I mean, it's mostly going to be robots that are going to get blown up here. Do you think that's a good thing?
Yeah, you know, I think it's an interesting question, and it is one that gets debated around military ethics circles. I don't think it's an imminent case at hand, and that's because the problems with the robot technology is it's good for the fight afar, but in the end, if you ever have to put people on the ground, that's when war is at its ugliest, and we are very, very far away from being able to put robots in for us as individual soldiers.
Hmm.
And so as long as we are going to have people on the ground, and ISIS and other groups like ISIS are willing to use some of their barbaric tactics,
right,
you know, war is still going to be very ugly at a very human scale.
Is it safer to have computers making the decisions in war than people? I mean, I'm not talking about big macro strategy decisions, but obviously, in every war, we see targets that are, you know, hit that shouldn't be. We see friendly fire, even. Are computers better or worse than people in figuring those and navigating those really tricky decisions that you're always making in war?
Well, I can tell you, as a person who works every day on perception technology, we are nowhere close to developing a computer vision system that has the ability to identify and discriminate friendly versus potential hostile targets. And so, and this is just, it's just a core assumption in robotics that if you cannot perceive the environment and perceive the person and know that that person is unequivocally good or bad, and also whether or not they're friendlies in the area, for example, you simply cannot then make the decision. Now, if we ever get to the point where we can perceive the environment correctly with very, very few errors, then one could make the argument that a more logical, unemotional computer could potentially make a better decision for a human. But then that all still hinges upon the assumption that the computer vision problem is solved, and we are very far from solving that.
This is probably where Missy and I differ, because it all turns on what do you mean by better? So, for example, speed. It's clear that digital systems can operate quicker. And that's why we are already seeing, whether we want to admit it or not, lots of different roles in warfare turned over to artificial intelligence, computerized decision systems. So as an example, 30 different countries have some kind of air defense system that automatically acquires and fires at a target, you know, an incoming missile or rocket that's just happening too quick for the human to do so. And the U.S. military is one of those. Simply put, the human can't react quick enough. Or you have domains of war where the human just can't process things in the same way. So, for example, you know, our vision of submarine warfare is, you know, Jonesy listening to the sonar with his really good ear.
Right.
That hasn't been true for 30 years. It's all algorithms that are basically saying this thing sounds like a Chinese kilo class sub automatically fire on. But there may be other things that you care. You know what? I care about law and ethics more. And so it's, even if the machine may be more efficient or effective, I'm uncertain about who to hold responsible. So I think there's a really good illustration of this is, you know, what if I said we could put a system out on our highways that would kill 3,000 people a year? You'd be like, oh my God, that's horrible. Don't put it out there. But what if I framed the question different and said, we could put robotic cars out there that, yes, about 3,000 a year would die from it, but it would save the lives of roughly 30,000 people that die in preventable traffic accidents. Which one do we go with?
Right.
Well, that's not a scientific question. That's like a legal, ethical question.
Right. And part of the tricky thing about this is, you know, you think about the trials at Nuremberg or something. We used to know, you know, who you would put on trial. But if it's a robot making judgments, killing people, how do you decide? I mean, how do you hold people responsible? How do you legally follow up on that after the conflict is done? I mean, do either of you ever think about, like, the implications of that?
Yeah, and you also, you have not just the question of the creator. Is it the creator? Is it the operator? And, you know, this is, whether it's Nuremberg to, frankly, that's the story of Dr. Frankenstein. The other thing is how, well, again, whether we like to admit it or not, our attitudes towards both technology, but also law and ethics change depending often on the context. So a great illustration of this would be submarines were once a science fiction technology. Then they get used in war. America thinks that it's utterly horrible to use them to target civilian shipping. It's actually why we enter World War I. We consider it such a violation of the laws of war to carry out unrestricted submarine warfare. Then Pearl Harbor happens. You know how long it took us to reevaluate our stand on using submarines that way? 5 hours.
Wow.
Because guess what? We were losing and we were pissed off.
Right. So I have a question for both of you, but I'm going to start with Missy first, sort of a final question here. When you look out at the future of warfare, which you think about all the time, what scares you the most? What kind of keeps you up at night?
What really bothers me is that a lot of decision makers and policy makers make or think about making policies without being informed of the technology and the capabilities of the technology. And it's a complicated world. You know, a lot of these machine learning, artificial intelligence programs that you hear so much about, they're very mathematically intensive. There's some serious problems. The computer vision problem I talked about before, you know, it's not just a small problem. It's the long pole in the tent if we're talking about targeting people with robots. And so I think that a lot of decisions get made in a technology vacuum, and I'm concerned that there are certainly not enough technology-based people inside the government who understand the limitations of the technology, who then potentially go on to make policy. But, of course, this is a problem that propagates throughout the media, in education. We cannot turn out enough people who actually have the both technology wherewithal, but also the policy understanding. And that gap continues to grow, again, because of the pull of these really top people out to Silicon Valley into the commercial sector. And so, you know, I do spend a lot of time talking around the country about what are the technology capabilities and limitations. And, you know, I'm only one person. We need about, you know, 1,000 more of me out there trying to educate policymakers on what's really about to happen.
Peter, I want to hear what keeps you up at night, but does that gap that Missy talks about seem to you, too, like it's really, you know, a serious problem?
Oh, it's a huge problem, and you see it in almost every field, whether it's, you know, the discussion of robotics. I remember meeting with a senator a couple years ago and having to explain to him that there wasn't a little person that sat inside the Predator drone. To, you know, in the same things that played out with on the cybersecurity side, where we have senior leaders who, you know, literally don't use email and are proud of it. So it definitely plays out there. When it comes to the future of war overall, I think of the period right before World War I, particularly in the militaries, there was an attitude that because of these technologies, war would be quick and easy. And the exact same thing is happening when you look at both Chinese military doctrine and American military doctrine. Phrases like short, sharp, quick are used consistently. And so people either look at war as an impossibility or something as easy. And that means that you're more likely, what scares me is that means you're more likely to make the kind of mistakes for war to start either by accident or by intent because you think it's just going to be so darn easy. And that's the sort of thing that sets you up for a fall.
Peter Singer is a senior fellow at the New America Foundation. He's the author of Wired for War and Ghost Fleet. Missy Cummings is the director of Duke's Humans and Autonomy Lab. Thanks to both of you for this great conversation.
Thanks.
Thank you.
We've got one more tidbit from our discussion on our SoundCloud page and at innovationhub.org about how the face of our military is changing.
All these different roles on the ship, everything from firefighting to navigation to the engine room to cooks, have all been turned over to robotics.